Case number 19-2058, Beth Chubb et al. Versus Daimler Trucks NA LLC. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Lane, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, your honors, good morning. Thomas Lane on behalf of defendant appellant Daimler Trucks North America. The district court below tried hard but ultimately got its decision wrong due to a common misunderstanding, conflating concepts of statutory standing with those related to jurisdiction. Now, this appeal really presents a classic law school type civil procedure exam question that once the concepts are defined and understood, is easily answered. Let's talk first very briefly about Article 3 standing, which is not really in dispute, but it's good to understand what we're talking about. In its most basic form, as discussed by this court in Roberts, it's a question of whether a plaintiff is sufficiently adverse to a defendant to create a case or controversy. Moving on to Michigan traditional notions of standing, there are several ways that you can meet the standing requirement under the Michigan Supreme Court's decision in Lansing. Number one, possessing a valid...
Isn't the question, counselor, not whether you can meet the case or controversy requirement, but what does Michigan law require for standing?
I think that is true. And I think the way that Michigan phrases it in the Lansing case, in Lansing, I think we all recognize, really tried to put together Michigan standing law after a morass of cases, really put it in a little bit of disarray. And once you get to Lansing, what Lansing has decided, the Michigan's highest court has decided that you can establish standing one of two ways. Number one, if you have a cause of action, that's the easy way to do it, but that's not the end of the inquiry. A litigant will also be deemed to have standing under Michigan law if that litigant has a special right or injury or a substantial interest that will be detrimentally affected in a manner different from the citizenry at large. And really, that's the key, different from the citizenry at large.
Well, there's a base question here. Much of your briefing is about federal law and statutory standing. But the question seems to me to govern this case is Lansing's teaching that Michigan standing is not equal to federal constitutional Article III standing. And you help me understand this, but what I read is that Lansing explains that federal courts, that this is true, the difference relies on the fact that the federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. And so they have powers that are enumerated. And that includes Article III case and controversy requirements. But the state courts, they retain everything that was not ceded to the federal government. And for that reason, they have inherent what they call prudential standing requirements that are defined by Michigan law, aren't they? And not by federal case or controversy law. Now, why is that? Tell me if that's an incorrect analysis of Lansing.
I don't think that it is. I agree with Your Honor that we have to take a two-step process when we're looking at standing. Number one, Article III standing, and then you move into the Michigan standing. You have to really establish both because we're in a diversity case that's up in the court because the parties are diverse, obviously. But once you establish both of those, which I think not only have we done it, but it's not really in dispute, you move on to what really is the core issue of this appeal. And that core issue is statutory standing. And that's the heart of this appeal.
Can a state ever affect whether or not we have jurisdiction? I can't imagine a scenario where a state can tell us by their law whether we have jurisdiction. I get it going to a cause of action, but can it ever impact our jurisdiction?
I get that question because I asked that question around a roundtable yesterday. Isn't it an odd notion that you need to look to the state law to determine whether or not this court or the district court had jurisdiction? I think it's a little bit of a misnomer. What you're really doing is you're looking to determine, okay, is there standing so that we sufficiently understand there's the case and controversy and we're dealing with parties that are sufficiently adverse to each other. But once we make that threshold finding, we really move into the core issue, which the courts have determined, hey, this idea of statutory standing has frequently been conflated and confused with the issue of jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction specifically. In statutory jurisdiction is really where Judge Berg down below, I guess I would say, lost his way in his—
And you're talking about state statutory jurisdiction, because obviously Congress can limit our jurisdiction.
I think they can and they do. Right. But in this case, if you look at the Michigan decision in the Lyle case, when it's talking about statutory standing, it's actually citing from the Lexmark case, which is a Supreme Court decision, of course, federal. And what it's doing in that case specifically is it's pointing out that, and here's the quote, "We have on occasion referred to this inquiry as statutory standing and treated it effectively as jurisdictional. This nomenclature is misleading, as the absence of a valid cause of action does not implicate subject matter jurisdiction. Galleria versus Nationwide, a 2016 decision out of this court, held similarly." So really where Judge Berg got it wrong, and I don't fault him for getting it wrong, because these can be confusing concepts when you're going back and forth between the federal courts and the state court. But where he got it wrong, where he made his mistake, was he decided that he did not have the power to adjudicate the case. And it really happened on page 9 of his decision.
Assume we agree with you and that he got that wrong and that this was an adjudication on the merits. You're asking that we assume it's a dismissal with prejudice, but Rule 41 pretty clearly gives that discretion to a district judge. Wouldn't we have to remand to Judge Berg to determine whether it's with prejudice or without prejudice?
Well, I think that's a possibility, but I think the better approach is to look at the cases where routinely a merits inquiry, that's what we're dealing with in this case. Is there a cause of action? Were these plaintiffs authorized under this statute?
You agree it's a discretionary call under Rule 41, right?
I think I'd have to agree with that, Your Honor.
And so then how do we do abuse of discretion review when we don't know how he would exercise his discretion?
I think because it's a clear error of law when you look at his decision. A clear error of law is per se an abuse of discretion.
You know, but the clear error of law was whether or not he had jurisdiction, not whether or not it was an adjudication. I mean, if he found he had jurisdiction, I'm sure he would have taken the next step and found that it was an adjudication on the merits. And then under 41, I think it's B or 41B, it's presumed it's an adjudication. It's presumed it's with prejudice, but he can say it's without, right? Isn't that the effect of 41B, if I remember it correctly?
I agree that it is presumed that it's without prejudice, or excuse me, that it is with prejudice.
Okay.
Right. So ultimately, Judge Berg had jurisdiction to decide and adjudicate this case because it could have been heard in a Michigan court. This is a wrongful death case. Of course, a Michigan court can hear that case. And then when we have diversity of jurisdiction, it bumps up to the federal courts. And of course, federal courts can hear wrongful death cases that are based upon diversity. Because we're dealing with statutory standing, and because we know that this is a merits inquiry, meaning that these plaintiffs are authorized to pursue this particular case, and we know they're not because they conceded they do not have the proper letters of authority.
How do you respond on the consideration that this is, this case boils down to the discretionary rights of the district court. How do you respond to Michigan's law about what is the appropriate dismissal in cases where there's a failure of capacity to file? I'm thinking of the George Morris Cruises case from 91, when Michigan was in its limited prudential doctrine that was brought back by Lansing. And it said very clearly that when a failure to meet a statutory filing requirement, a dismissal should be without prejudice. Is it, yeah. Your briefing seems to argue that that is not even available to a federal district judge. So, is that still your position?
That is our position. I think there's plenty of case law where you look at the underlying facts. We have plaintiffs who had their opportunity to be qualified. They, through neglect, allowed that opportunity to pass. And because they so clearly let it pass, let those letters lapse, the court can look at this and say quite clearly that they are no longer authorized. They do not have a cause of action because they are not authorized. And these particular plaintiffs should not be given a second chance. They had their
chance. And can that judge also say, and I'm exercising my discretion to dismiss without prejudice?
In certain circumstances, he might be able to say that. I don't think those are the circumstances before us.
Thank you. Your time's up. Mr. Broderick.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I definitely have a different reading on Lansing than counsel. I think in reading that case, it's very clear that you can establish standing under Michigan law one of two ways. If there's a statutory grant, the analysis is over. The statute defines who and can sue and who can't sue. It's when there's a more nebulous or open-ended question where the statute does not provide guidance, where you have to go into a more classic, traditional law school type standing case and controversy requirement. And I think the case specifically states on page 372 that where a cause of action is not provided by law, then a court should, in its discretion, determine whether a litigant has standing. In this case, we have a tort claim brought in the federal district court based on diversity and the amount of controversy requirement. There is no federal tort involved in this case. It's your classic products liability type action defined by Michigan law under Michigan's wrongful death statute. I also think that the case law is very clear that in this circumstance, the court, the district court, has to look to state law for guidance on the substantive, not the procedural, but the substantive matters before it. And I think the district court,
the state can limit our jurisdiction.
I don't think the state can limit this court's, the federal court's jurisdiction, no. But
so then isn't standing purely an Article III question for us? And then the fact that they might not have standing in state court goes to the merits?
I disagree with Your Honor, because I think that this court has to apply the substantive law of the state or the federal district court when it's...
Well, let me give you a hypo. Suppose Michigan says foreign corporations can't sue in our court, okay? Michigan has a law that says foreign corporations are not allowed to sue in our court. Foreign corporation sues me in Michigan, and we're diverse. We meet all the jurisdictional requirements. Do we lose our jurisdiction? Assume they sue for breach of contract, so it's under Michigan law. Do we lose our jurisdiction because Michigan says foreign corporations don't have standing in their courts?
No, I don't think you do, but I don't think that that's the fact pattern here. I think respectfully that what you have is there is no equivalent statutory grant in the federal system. The law says that the district court has to apply state law the state law is very clear that the only person that can bring an action for wrongful death, or entity, I should say, is the personal representative. And I think
your client under Article 3 had injury in fact, right?
Oh, a variety of people did, yes, based on the death. That would be the spouse, the parents, the children, etc.
So I'm not sure why, if Michigan limited some part of the cause of action or said these people can't bring it, that would go to the cause of action and not whether or not they actually had injury in fact under Article 3. We can't displace, I mean, the Supreme Court's been very clear, right? We have to exercise the jurisdiction given to us. And state courts, I don't see a scenario in which a state court can take away federal jurisdiction. Give me a hypothetical where they could.
And I don't think I can do that, but I don't think that's what's happening here. I mean, the court is interpreting whether he has jurisdiction on this particular case, and he doesn't. And I think based on the statutory grant.
But you're saying based on the Michigan statute. So you are saying Michigan took away jurisdiction that otherwise existed under Article 3.
No, I don't think so. Because, I mean, again, this is a state law tort claim. There is no body of law in the federal system that talks about torts. It always looks to state law for guidance. And given the fact that the original nature of this claim is a state law tort claim, it has to look to state law because there's no body it could look to on the merits of the case itself. And I think counsel in its reply talks about a case named Lyle, which, you know, first of all, it talks about intervention, not standing in the classic sense. And it's after what was known as Covenant. In Michigan courts, it used to be that health insurers had an independent right to sue. Covenant was decided by the Michigan Supreme Court in 2010, I believe, that indicated, no, you no longer have a statutory right to sue or an independent right to sue based on the statute. And so what it did is it created, quite frankly, a nightmare in the courts because all the providers then started filing what they call covenant motions, which would be intervention motions. So the case that Lyle, I don't believe, is germane or appropriate or applicable to the case here because, A, it buttresses the fact that absent a statutory grant, there is no standing to sue. It did allow under the court rule an ability to intervene by way of motion in an independent action. But again, that's not what happened here. It's not as if we had an estate that was intact and then some distant relative said, wait a minute, I didn't get notice from the probate court. I want to intervene in this case. So I think that it's not appropriate. And I would note that Michigan about a year ago then came back, the legislature did, and then granted the third party insurers in on no fault.
Counsel, if I could take you back to you read an accurate quote from Lansing about saying, well, if there's a specific cause of action, you're in. If there's not a specific cause of action, the court should exercise its discretion as to whether to grant standing and take jurisdiction. In our case, didn't the district judge stop at the first part? He said there's no statute, so therefore there's no standing. But he didn't go on to the second part of that quote that you actually read from Lansing.
That is correct.
Should we, yeah.
That is correct.
And so should we send it back for him to do that part?
No, I don't agree with that, Your Honor, because first of all, under the wrongful death statute, it's very particular how things have to be handled. It would be not in the interest of either justice or judicial economy to do such a thing. You know, we then get into the merits of service and everything else, which I'm sure you've read. And this all could have been obviated when I offered to substitute a party in before the court ruled.
Well, okay, but that's all water under the dam back in the lower courts.
Right.
But my puzzle here, and let me put it to both of you for your other side on rebuttal, that language from Lansing does seem to give, you know, if you read Lansing, it's all kind of pro-plaintiff on the majority side saying, well, maybe we should have more standing to help out the plaintiffs. But in this case, it's your adversary who's trying to get standing in order to kill the plaintiff, which I'm not sure how that comes out, but isn't that really where we are?
It is, Your Honor. I mean, there's a whole lot of fixable problems that haven't been fixed and were before you today for whatever reason. I guess if I'm a judge, and I'm not, far from it, but if I read Lansing and I read this quote and it says where cause of action is not provided at law, and I have the facts that are before you today, I don't think I can go to step two. I think what I say is, okay, counsel, you have, your clients have a statutory cause of action. For whatever reason, you're not positioned correctly under the statute, get it right and come back. But I don't think I have a right to then say, okay, well, I'm going to ignore there's this statutory right, and I'm going to then go into the more traditional case and controversy. I think as a judicial officer, I think the lower court got it right. He analyzed it correctly in the sense that, okay, wait a minute, there is a cause of action here, but the proper parties are not before me. I can't dismiss with prejudice because those parties aren't here. It would be a nullity of no effect. His only option really was to dismiss without prejudice, because I don't think that quote allows him to go beyond that, because there is a statutory scheme and that parties are supposed to work within the rules that they have and not, okay, this failed and go, we'll go meander into something else. I disagree with that. Did I answer your question, sir? All right. So I think our position is that the lower court's ruling was correct. I mean, he was confronted with two competing motions. It was disclosed to counsel and, you know, I don't want to get into, you know, the pleadings speak for themselves. But the bottom line is he had a case with no proper plaintiff before it. But and the statutory scheme outlined how that had to be done. It's unfortunate for all concerned, but I don't think that a dismissal with prejudice would have been appropriate. The appellant has cited a couple cases where there was a dismissal with prejudice.
Isn't that a discretionary call under Rule 41? And isn't Rule 41 procedural?
It is, Your Honor. And I was just, I had Rule 41 pulled in it.
So doesn't that go back to the district? I mean, we can't exercise that discretion in the first instance. So doesn't that go back to the district court to decide whether it's with or without prejudice, and you can make all the arguments you want in front of the district court?
I do believe it's a discretionary grant, but I believe.
Assume for the sake of argument that the district court had jurisdiction, mm-hmm. that it goes to the merits, and that the district court could dismiss it with or without prejudice under Rule 41. Isn't that a call the district court makes in the first instance?
It is, and I believe 41 says that if there's no jurisdiction, it has to be without prejudice. And I could be misquoting that.
I'm saying assume there is Article 3 jurisdiction here. Because that's the only jurisdiction that is jurisdiction in the true sense of the word for a federal court.
Well, I guess I could assume that, then it is a discretionary grant, but I do disagree with that, because I think the jurisdiction is the diversity and the amount of controversy, not,
and
there's no need
met those requirements.
Right. But I do believe it's a discretionary grant. I would have to concede that, but not the dismissal with prejudice, I should say. And I would say, you know, two of the cases that appellant has cited,
they meet diversity and amount of controversy, right?
Correct. I do.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry if I interrupted. The two cases where appellant is cited, one is B.V. Dottori about a contract case. you know, it was decided under state law, but I think there, you know, the court could look beyond the facts and say, okay, does this person have standing to sue, and say clearly they didn't. The other case, the Hammer case, that was under a federal statute with lead paint, I believe, where, you know, this again, the court looked at a statutory grant of standing and found that the purported plaintiffs clearly had no standing. Here, you have the lower court judge looking at behind the scenes as, could somebody have standing? And the answer is yes, absolutely. They may not be positioned well, but in that instance, I'm dismissing without prejudice. But in those other cases where a judge is looking behind the scenes at the facts and saying, could this person have standing? The answer was absolutely not. Not under either the statutory grant with the lead paint or the contractual theory outlined under Ohio's statute. And I don't think I have anything else at this point.
Thank you. You will have your rebuttal, Mr. Lyon.
Thank you, Judge Strange. And Judge Boggs, you do make a very interesting point. Mr. Broderick and I have seemingly flipped positions from what you would expect in the typical case. And the arguments are not the usual that you would see, but I guess the procedural stance that we find ourselves in dictate those positions. I would like to address an earlier position about whether or not this should be remanded and let Judge Berg decide the issue. I guess the only additional point I would make in response to that inquiry is that really when you're looking at the merits and doing a merits inquiry, what you're doing is you're deciding whether or not there's a failure to state a claim. And under Rule 12b-6, when it's a failure to state a claim, those dismissals are typically with prejudice. To address Mr. Broderick's point with respect to Lansing, I do agree with the court that Lansing, you must look at Lansing in its totality and not simply certain excerpts out of that decision. And when you look at Lansing in its totality, it becomes evident that Judge Berg did not go far enough in the analysis. I think he got it right when he determined that this plaintiff did not have authority to sue, but I think that he didn't take it in the right direction or down the right path. And really where he veered was when he started to rely on the In re Beatrice Rottenberg case and when he stated that the principle of statutory standing is jurisdictional. That's just not correct. The estate of Lyle and the Galleria case prove that point that it's not a jurisdictional issue. Those issues are often conflated, and it's really a merits inquiry. Does our plaintiff have a cause of action? And here, without those letters of authority that they allowed to lapse, our plaintiff does not have a cause of action, and it should be dismissed with prejudice.
We thank you both for your arguments and for appearing electronically.
I'm sorry, Judge. No, could I ask what?
Please.
Could I just? Relate to one part then about what you said. When you say he didn't go far enough, the usual thing is then to say, okay, we ought to send it back for him to go appropriately further in that second part of the quote from Lansing. But I take it your position is that as a matter of law, he was required to say that this was a merits determination and he had no discretion the way that Judge Thapar has indicated. I take it you wouldn't be satisfied with a remand. And can you reprise then why not only did he get it wrong, but he had to go the other way?
Sure. So I think what I would do is I would start with the record before us. And the record before us has been developed. We don't need to send this down, in other words, for the district court to further develop the record. We have all that we need in front of us to decide this. And since we have all that we need for the decision to be made, the decision is akin to a 12B6 issue where because you cannot state a cause of action, these plaintiffs, due to the fact that they are not authorized under the statute because they allowed the letters to lapse. When you can't do that, it's a failure to state a claim, or it's akin to a failure to state a claim. And Judge Boggs, that determination can be made by this court, and the determination can be with prejudice.
Or it could be sent back down for the exercise of discretion by the district court under Rule 41 and Michigan law. Isn't that correct also?
If you're looking at it from the Rule 41 perspective, Judge Stranch, I won't disagree with you, but I do believe that this is more akin to a 12B6 issue, and it was converted to the 12B6 type of inquiry when Mr. Broderick came into court and informed the court that the letters of authority had expired, and that turned it into a merits-based inquiry at that time.
Okay. No further questions. We appreciate your arguments. Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement, and an opinion will be rendered in due course.